accession number 19930, reel 3.
Harry Lapidus, reel 3.
When we were at Memeo, across the lake, the Japanese were retreating and they had their geisha girls with them. And you can imagine what the British troops wanted to do. Either swim across the lake or run round quickly, which wasn't possible. So the Japs and the geishas got away. Well, by this time we were pretty exhausted and I think we were fairly fit, but we just didn't have enough men. And it was decided to take the division out. And as it happened, some of the division were to go on later to Mandalay, were going to Malaya, which was me, as one of them. We flew our guns back to India, and by this time there was a great demob scene going on. Various groups were being split and sent home. I think I was group 21. I can't remember. But anyway, I was on a group that was to stay. The regiment was reformed and transferred to 23rd Indian Division. I was naturally promoted as everybody was leaving. And for a time I commanded the battery until we had a new battery commander. Then I was battery captain and in charge of all the guns and vehicles on the transport ship going to Malaya for the reinvasion of Malaya. Interesting, on our way to Madras, I was also happened to be officer commanding the troop train, and we stopped in a siding just outside Madras. Very, very hot. We opened the doors, and in my carriage there were 10 officers. I stepped out onto the platform and saw a brigadier approaching. He'd got his red hat on and his red epaulettes. He came to me and said, I've got good news for you. The Americans this morning dropped a bomb on Tokyo that's going to finish the war. And I looked at him in amazement, thinking about any bomb that could finish a war. And I said, what sort of bomb, sir? And he said, I don't know, but it's going to finish the war. Tell the troops. Before I could say any more, he went. When I told my fellow officers, they were as amazed as me. We knew what a 1,000-pound bomb could do, and our own 25-pounder shells, but a bomb to finish the war? When I told the sergeant major to tell the troops, he laughed. He didn't believe it. And I said, well, the brigadier said, tell the troops, let's tell them. So we brewed up tea from the engines. We always used to make tea from the steam. And we told the troops. But they were absolutely amazed. They just didn't believe it. Except that we were told that we were going to be delayed 3 weeks. Pardon me. At sea. So that the news could get through to the Japanese. In various places. Then I think they started to believe a little bit of it. Anyway, we did stay an extra 3 weeks at sea. To make sure that the Japs had got there orders from their emperor. And in fact, we were right next to the Richelieu, the great German battleship that, don't know where it was when they'd been sunk.
The French battleship.
French battleship. I don't know where it was when they were sunk at Mers el Kebir, but she was there. Anyway, we landed ashore in Malaya, and that beach had not been surveyed. And by H plus 2, there were probably 150 vehicles and guns in various hillocks out at sea. There would have been absolute sitting ducks for the Japanese. Fortunately, they had stopped. Now, this landing was between Port Swettenham and Port Dickson on the west coast of Malaya, near Kuala Lumpur. The names have changed today. We then went down to Singapore and saw some of our POWs. Also saw a Japanese camp commandant who'd cut his throat because he'd been recognized. And he had his throat stitched up. And when he saw another, somebody else who would have recognized him, he tore his stitches open again.
Did he survive?
Yes, they hung him. The news from Java was serious. The Japanese had handed over control of the camps to Indonesians, and we were advised to go. Three officers, including myself, were flown in on a small light plane, and the troops came on LCTs, which was going to take 2 days. So we landed at Batavia. I think the name's changed now. And the Japanese were okay. They gave us beer. And told us not to do anything until the bulk of troops arrived. So we spent 2 nights there. And then the troops arrived. We disarmed the Indonesians, and within the space of a week or so released the Dutch women and children who were interned there.
How did you set about disarming the Indonesians?
Just ask them. The Indonesian, once we were there in bulk, but disarmed the guards. We did what we didn't know was that we hadn't disarmed the major part of them. So the Dutch men had been separated from the women and children, and I think the men had been sent inland somewhere. Dutch children, I believe, under 5 years of age, stayed with their parents, with their mother. And they were crowded into very small rooms, and in 4 years or so that they were interned, obviously these children had grown, and it made it very, very difficult. However, the Dutch women were asked to point out the houses they'd been in, and Dutch people also started arriving, trying to put matters in order. The Indonesians were okay. They didn't interfere with us, they didn't interfere with the Dutch. But within a short time, a Dutch brigade arrived. They'd been in Penang, and they arrived in Batavia. And from that day onwards, all hell was let loose. The Indonesians didn't like it. They didn't, although they'd been friendly with us, they didn't like us then. And we more or less had to let the Dutch take over. They did, I believe, send in the paras from Europe, because I remember the commanding officer was Roy Leyland, the old rugby international. But they made it even worse because they weren't used to how things were conducted in the Far East, if you like.
How do you mean specifically?
Well, we would have adopted a quieter attitude, I think. I think they were openly ready to fight the Indonesians, where they'd been 6 or 8 weeks with us and they'd been quiet and hadn't may have caused any problems. And by this time, of course, the Japanese had handed their weapons in, and I was at a place where there were probably 4,000 of them handed weapons in. But the officers were allowed to keep their swords because they said they couldn't keep discipline without them. When the Japanese troops laid down their arms and they'd all finished, they laid them in stacks, they let out an enormous roar that was really frightening. I don't know what it meant, but it probably meant the end of the war for them. But that was it. We saw no Kempeitai. They had probably gone before we got there.
So this is in Batavia?
Batavia. About, I was, the colonel asked me, our colonel asked me if I would stay on and become a regular soldier. But I'd been away long enough. I'd actually been away about 6.5 years, I suppose, and had only one Christmas at home. So I thought I might have got home for the Christmas of 1945, but I didn't. I left in January and arrived in Liverpool in early February 1946. My equipment had all been stolen, and I landed just in a uniform. I went up to Lancaster, was issued with a suit and a shirt, and because I had no greatcoat, the quartermaster sergeant gave me an army blanket to come home in. We were never met. We had no examination. I can never remember having a blood test during the whole time I was in the army. I can never remember having my blood pressure taken. But then probably at that age, you don't need it. But nobody asked how we were. Nobody said anything. And I think probably that was the thing that lingered mostly on our memories after.
Does that cause you a sense of grievance to think of? Does that cause you a sense of grievance to think about then?
No. What really makes me feel grieved about things is the fact that at the end of the war, Britain probably demobilized the finest men it's ever had in its history. They were tough. They'd done everything without complaining. They'd gone through, I suppose, hell and all. And all they wanted to do was to come home, go back to their wives, go back to their parents, work again like they did before the war. but people had got their jobs. Some of the people who hadn't gone to the war had got the best jobs. And I'm afraid that those men who you could have done absolutely anything with were pushed about until eventually they started striking, they started doing all sorts of things. But if they'd have been treated properly and even been thanked, I'm sure that it wouldn't have happened.
You told me earlier off the tape about how you, what happened to you once you'd been processed at the Demob Centre in Lancaster.
Yeah. Mm.
How you travelled away from Lancaster.
Yeah. I had a warrant, and the old quartermaster sergeant said to me, "Where are you going?" And I said, "I live in Anglesey." And he said, "Well, you'll only be able to get to Chester by train, really, because I think trains go along the coast once every day, or something like that. But if you walk 2 miles out of the station and go westwards, you'll come to the big main road." Remember, I'd been away for about 4 years, I suppose. Come to the big main road, and you'd be able to catch a lift from a petrol lorry or an army lorry, probably going to Rhyl, which is exactly what I did. And I did it with an army blanket. And it was, I think, the first week in February. Interestingly, about 4 years ago, my wife and I were in Palm Beach in Florida, and we went to a hotel for dinner. We'd been there before, and they had chicken piri piri on the menu, which I asked for. When it came, it hadn't been cooked correctly near the bone, the chicken hadn't. So I asked the waiter if he would mind popping it under the microwave. He went. A lady arrived and she apologized. And she said, "I'm the manageress. I'm Dutch, but I lived many years in England. But I wasn't born in Holland." I said, "Were you born in Java?" She said, "Yes." She said, "But I was interned when I was 4. She said, "The greatest sight I ever saw, and my mother too, was when the British soldiers arrived." So I said, "Well, I think I was one of those." She said, "You can't pay for your dinner." I said, "It didn't come for that." Anyway, we had a drink with her and talked to her many times after, and she'd been a baby and she remembered us.
What are your memories of the liberation of the internees in Java?
They thought they were never going to be liberated, and they had nothing, because everything had been taken away from them. But they were fantastic with us, really. Wonderful people. I can only speak too highly of them.
Did you go to their camp?
Well, we released them from their camp. And gradually, within 3 or 4 weeks, we gradually got them back to their homes. We opened the big go-downs up and let them take the carpets and whatever was there to make themselves comfortable.
What condition did they seem to be in?
Oh, in very, very, very poor condition. But amazingly, within 3 or 4 weeks, they all started looking much better. They were thin. Some of them had the swollen stomachs. But we got them right. I think that they wouldn't have lasted much longer.
Did you have any problems readjusting to civilian life after the war?
Yes. I was walking. I think I had 9 weeks leave, paid leave, because while we'd been in Java, we had been given Japanese printed guilders. So we'd all accumulated a little bit of money. I think I had about £120 or something, which was quite a lot in those days. But I'd been home about a fortnight, and I was walking in Bomaris, the little place where I lived. I remember it was very cold, and the local doctor, Dr. Thomas, who used to like a drink, saw me, and he said, "God, you look thin. Where have you been?" And I said, "Well, I've been in the Far East." He said, "Well, you'd better come in and see me." So he examined me. That was the first examination I had. And he said, "Well, I think you'd be all right, but you'd better drink Guinness." That was his cure. So I drank Guinness for a couple of months. I probably put on too much weight. But I was down to about 10 stone 6 then, where my normal weight is 11.4.
What about your psychological state and your attitudes at the end of the war?
Well, I certainly didn't want to be an estate agent or a surveyor anymore. Although in 1949, years after, they gave us our letters. I think 700 of us had our letters given to us. So I helped my mother in her pub. The Welsh Guards had been there during the war and had treated her very well. People were coming home on leave and coming to Rhyl and Llandudno, coming there by coach, and we started doing teas and lunches and things like that. And gradually I found it very difficult to go back to my wife, although I had a little boy. And it was my mother who really said, "Look, you've got to go and start again." I mean, I had all sorts of ideas of what she might have been doing during the war, but then I hadn't been a very good boy either. So, and my mother said, "You go back and you start again and you try." Within a few years, we had two more children. So that was it. Then I had a happy life. Unfortunately, she's dead now. But my children have turned out well, for which I'm grateful.
How do you feel now about having served in the Second World War in the Royal Artillery?
I wouldn't have had it any other way. I think if I had my time over again, I would do the same thing. That's the only way. We can't just give up everything we fought for. Whether I'm allowed to say about going into Europe, I don't know. But if we're not good enough to do it by ourselves, we're certainly not good enough to do it with people who let us down every day. We can do it if we try with a proper leadership. And we could probably be another Switzerland.
Did you have any nightmares about the war after it had finished?
Oh, yes. You do get nightmares. And I had malaria for about 5 years, of course. But you wake up from a nightmare and it's another day. It's always been another day for me, fortunately. I got over it, and I became reasonably successful in my life. I chose not to go to, with Trust House 40. I could have gone with Charles 40. I chose not to go to the big groups in London. I chose to try to do it by myself. Then I came to Jersey in 1956.
Could I ask you what was the subject of these war nightmares that you mentioned? What was the subject matter?
Well, I think it was that there was no end. It went on. Nightmares just went on and on. And I used to wake myself up from them, like sort of shake myself. But it was nothing very terrible. It was just the fact that nothing turned out right. It always seemed to be not quite turning out. But nothing really horrible.
What did you think of the Japanese when you were fighting them in Burma?
Well, one day I saw a Japanese, I saw a corporal of the East Lancs. I was going to an observation post, and they'd just shot two Japanese. And we, as we went round and through the jungle, we came to the small clearing where they were. And he said, "No problem now, sir. You can get up to your OP. We've just got these two." And he pushed his mouth open with his boot, looking for gold teeth, and he kicked them out, picked them like that, threw the teeth away, put it in his pocket. "I'll spend that in Calcutta next week when I get my leave." I often wonder whether he ever had a leave. Don't know. He didn't. I couldn't hurt a flea now. But it didn't mean a thing then. We hated the Japanese. They killed two South Lancs, as it happened, and put their boots on the side of a trench. I'd like a ritual, which, that was a bit frightening. They just put the boots on the side of the trench like that. And the guys were at the bottom of the trench. But we knew that the Japanese had made our people pull rickshaws when they were running with dysentery. And even when they used to bring the this thing they held in front of them, which said they, if they gave themselves up, they would be prisoners of war. I'm afraid we just filled them full of lead. The infantry couldn't stand them. And we couldn't either. I've never been to Japan. Perhaps I ought to go. We had a little Japanese girl who's at school with my daughter. We took her out, and she was nice. But I'm too old to start thinking about things like that now. We'll take this little girl out again sometime.